The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 336, a panel discussion entitled Steps in the Right Direction, Evaluating New LDS Publications on Homosexuality, with Robert A. Rees, Hugo Olays, Ron Scow, and Bill Bradshaw.
According to the instructions I've been given, we're supposed to start on time. And so we will begin. My name is Bob Rees. I am chairing this session of Sunstone. It's session number 336 for whoever's recording this. I'm pleased to be here with friends and colleagues whose minds and hearts I have come to trust as people of integrity and deep passionate concern for issues relating to sexual identity and gender within the Mormon community. We will spend some time, each of the panelists will take a little bit of time to present some part of the discussion for the day, and then we would like to have an opportunity for people in the audience to ask questions or make brief comments. No sermons allowed today. I chaired a session of the Sunstone West Symposium on the new book, In Quiet Desperation, Understanding the Challenge of Same-Gender Attraction, which was published by Deseret Book recently, within the past year. I commend Deseret Book for the courage to publish such a book and hope that it has a wide readership and that people let Deseret Book know of their appreciation. One of the experiences of the Sunstone West Conference, one of the things that happened at that conference was that Connell O'Donovan, a gay Latter-day Saint, or I would probably characterize him as an ex-Latter-day Saint, nevertheless a man with a great deal of deep roots within the Mormon community, who probably has the most extensive library on homosexuality in the Mormon culture of anyone in or out of the church. And in that session of conference, I had Carolyn Pearson spoke, and Connell Donovan did. And for Connell's part on the program, he simply read the names of the known Latter-day Saint homosexuals who have committed suicide within the past 20 to 25 years. It was a sobering and, in some ways, even a sacred litany of loss, a reminder of the cost paid by a number of our brothers and sisters for our continuing ignorance and indifference regarding these issues. The history of the world can be looked at as the history partially of the destructiveness of wrong ideas. The world is flat. Women are inferior to men. The earth revolves around the sun. The sun revolves around the earth, I mean. I think that's the way. Bill, correct me. It is God's will to blow up innocent people in the service of a righteous cause. Sexual orientation can be changed through the atonement of Jesus Christ. There are some wrong ideas that don't seem to have too serious a consequences as we look at them. There are others that do. Thomas Jefferson said, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility toward any form of tyranny over the mind of man." we might add, over the heart, mind, or spirit of men or women, or even of those non-human creatures who share the earth with us. I've just finished reading a review of In Quiet Desperation that appears on the FAIR website, which I would categorize as a kind of tyranny. I feel that the disservice that it does to both the Mattises, who wrote the book In Quiet Desperation on their son, and also to a young Latter-day Saint, Ty Mansfield, who bears his soul in that book, and the way in which the authors of this review of the book speak of them and of those who hold ideas that may be contrary to the ideas of the authors of that review, I have come to recognize as a form of tyranny. We will have presentations today from people of different perspectives on issues relating to homosexuality. Ron Scow, who is the co-author with his brother, who is here, of In Peculiar People, who have for the past 20 or 25 years been among the voices of reason within the Mormon community to bring some kind of sensible dialogue to this issue. Dr. William Bradshaw, a professor of science at Brigham Young University, who has acquired some notoriety for speaking the truth from a scientific point of view, and who has received, I think, a number of responses from people expressing appreciation for his courage in speaking out about what our understanding is of scientific knowledge about homosexuality. Hugo Liz has been also a persistent voice of reason and compassion about these matters. One of the questions that people keep asking me as I have labored in this particular vineyard for the past 25 years, since the time that I was the bishop of a singles congregation in Los Angeles, in which I found shortly after becoming bishop that I had a number of gay and lesbian Latter-day Saints within my congregation, and that began for me a schooling of my heart as well as my spirit as to what it means to be homosexual in a culture that is not sympathetic to and has not had a very favorable record of dealing with homosexuality. From that time, in which, as I say, my heart and spirit were schooled by good men and women who felt absolutely torn between their devotion to the church to which they had given their allegiance and their own experience with their identity as homosexuals or as transsexuals, as bisexuals, led me to believe that this is one of the fields in which I was either called or called myself to labor. Over the period since that time, I have had a lot of primary experience with probably 50 homosexuals, and I have come to trust their experience as well as the integrity of their souls. And as I have said in other places, I am convinced by the totality of their experience that I have not met anyone who fits that category or those categories who did not try desperately over a long period of time to bring all of the spiritual resources available to them to try and change their orientation and to fit an expected profile of what they should be. Nor have I met any one of those of my acquaintance who was successful in spite of what I categorize as heroic, faithful efforts to change their orientation who was able to do so. I have to trust that experience, as well as the experience of many others whose experience I have read about or have been told about. Part of the difficulty is that we are dealing with a highly complex, ambiguous, in many ways scientifically unresolved set of issues about this matter. And that if truth is the daughter of time, we hope that before eternity comes on this issue, we'll have found more truth than we now have. But the thing that I would caution you is that any time you find dogmatism, any time you find absolute certainty being espoused about these issues, as you find in this review in FAIR, be certain that what you're reading is not the complete truth. People ask me, as I have been involved in this issue, am I hopeful? Can one expect the dawning of a brighter day when it comes to these issues within the church? I am by nature, by disposition, a hopeful person. My experience with people over the course of my nearly 70 years has led me to believe and trust in the common wisdom and the common goodness of people. I am impatient for faster change, partly because, and maybe essentially because, of what it means to so many individuals and their families. But I remain hopeful because there are many good people who are laboring to bring about the change that is necessary before we have full equality socially, politically, and ecclesiastically for people of all gender orientations. A number of years ago, when I was at UCLA during the Watts riots, many of my many people, the colleagues and students, thought we should shut down the university. And as I was teaching a class on the American Renaissance, a group of students came through, marching through the campus, and they came into my classroom and they said, "We're asking you to shut down your class and to close the university because business should not be done as usual, given what's going on in Cambodia, what went on at Kent, what's going on in Watts." And I said to them, "What I'm doing here right now, trying to have a dialogue with young people about ideas, about the history of the humanities, about who we are as human beings, I think is the most important thing that I can do. It's not the only thing I can do," and so I organized a series of lectures called The Perspectives on the Current Crisis, and had a number of my colleagues come and look at what was happening in terms of literary and historical perspectives. At the same time, I went to pick up Arthur Henry King, the distinguished professor of literature who later came to teach Shakespeare at BYU. And I was telling him that I was somewhat discouraged by what was happening around me in the culture. And he said, "You have to believe, Bob, that one person can always make a difference. That," he said, "is the key to how we move forward as a civilization." So I believe that many individuals are making a difference, and some of them are the people that we will hear from today. I'm going to ask Ron and then Hugo and then Bill to take some time to talk about some perspectives on this, and then I hope that we have some time for your questions.
I plan to make some comments about what I see as the current status in the LDS Church with reference to some of these books and booklets and other resources that I've been working on and some of us have been working on, and how this seems to reflect perhaps some hopeful movement within the church. There's an organization that has a hotline to receive phone calls from people who are dealing with homosexual issues within the LDS Church. And this is a hotline that has been promoted some by with bishops and with other LDS Church leaders. And I've been told by the executive director who runs this hotline that they receive over 150 requests every month from individuals within the church who are dealing with homosexuality themselves. The interesting thing is that 40% of these requests come from married men, 10% come from women, 50% from single men, single saints. What I think that shows us is that we are still having too many men with homosexual attraction getting married, because that's a lot of phone calls. And so why do so many people still end up in these kind of marriages? It's primarily because of misinformation. And I think there are two main issues that we can focus on that will help us reverse this trend. These marriages tend to get in trouble. And some of us here have had a lot of experience with talking to people who have been in these kind of marriages. And so why do so many of these relationships fail? Primarily because the homosexual attraction of one spouse creates a major difficulty, despite hopes that such attraction will diminish over time. In reality, the great majority of those who are homosexually oriented cannot fundamentally alter their feelings by desire, therapy, or religious practice. And Bob talked about spiritual responses, but I think he would also add, having worked with a therapist with many of these people in his ward, that therapy was not the answer either. So our culture, unfortunately, exerts tremendous pressure for us all to marry, because that's the way we achieve exaltation, etc. But this is a condition that is not chosen, and it doesn't go away. And if we don't understand that, then these marriages will continue to happen. Let me state what I think is the most important information we have available. Bob referred to the farm's website and what, the fair website, and what is produced there as supposed scientific evidence that contradicts what we're saying to you today. But I think that this information is the crucial information in Mormon culture. An LDS family services therapist who has been in communication with me for a couple of years now on a regular basis has described to us his clinical experience, which is likely the most extensive experience of anyone working with single and married homosexual Latter-day Saint men. He's worked with a lot of women too, but his data is more easy to report with the men. He's worked with approximately 800 men in more than 30 years. Approximately half of these clients left counseling after one or two sessions. The other half, who are in therapy for 1 to 3 years, include roughly 200 single men. And of those 200 single men who all, like everybody in our culture, wants to marry and live the good LDS life, of those 200 in therapy for 1 to 3 years, only 20 were able to do so. And he tells us that 19 out of those 20 were bisexual to begin with. Now, the bisexual issue is a key issue. I believe it is one of the things that helps us understand why these things are continuing to happen in our culture. If you are bisexual, you have attractions to men, well, to the same sex and to the opposite sex. If you have enough attractions to the opposite sex, you can get in a marriage and make that marriage work. It will be possible. And so some people who have these homosexual feelings and who are bisexual and who get into a marriage and have success there think that their experience can generalize to somebody who is fully homosexual. I think we have a number of church leaders who have had that personal experience and who then counsel people to go ahead and get married. And so the message is that if someone is fully homosexual, that is not a possibility. Now, there are other things that have to be taken into consideration. Some people are asexual. They don't have any libido. If two people get married that don't have any libido, maybe they can make such a marriage work. But that's not the case for most people in our culture. So one of the reasons so many homosexuals enter into such high-risk marriages is that they are encouraged to do so by many LDS counselors, therapists, ecclesiastical leaders who are ill-informed about the nature of homosexuality and the dangers of homosexual-heterosexual bonding. This review that we talked about was developed by people who have promoted this nonstop. These people, some of them have been in the bureaucracy of the church, and they have pushed past the leaders of the church in pushing an agenda which has hurt so many, many people. It's a tyranny, as Bob says. Well, let me move to what I think that is the sad news, the disappointing news, that kind of pressure still is in our culture to push people into marriages where they really should not be. And this is the good news. Even though there is currently much pain and uncertainty over the issue of homosexuality in Mormon culture, there are several developments which, given time and encouragement, may lead to a more enlightened situation. An encouraging sign is Deseret Book's publication of In Quiet Desperation. And I think I could add a bit more here. We know this is by Fred and Marilyn Mattis and Ty Mansfield. The Mattises are the parents of Stuart Mattis, an LDS man who committed suicide outside the Los Altos Stake Center in San Jose, California in 2000 after years of struggling against his homosexual orientation. The book strongly confirms that homosexual orientation is not a choice and generally will not diminish or vanish in adulthood. According to Marilyn Mattis, when Stuart was 32 years old, he finally accepted his feelings of attraction to other men. He said he cried all night long when he realized his feelings of attraction had not gone away, nor had they diminished in any way since he had first recognized them. The book's preface describes Ty Mansfield. You will read the reflections and impressions of another young man who presently wrestles with same-gender attraction. It will become obvious that he has spent hundreds of hours on his knees in counsel with priesthood leaders and in deep and pondering study of the Holy Scriptures in an effort to cope with the feelings of attraction that he did not choose. Because Deseret Book is owned by the church, its publication of this book with its strong message that homosexual attraction is not chosen and does not diminish over time is, in my opinion, a good sign. Now, we also have the statement from the First Presidency issued in October 2004, which I think reinforces these same messages. The church leaders seem to understand these two things I've been talking about. They understand that homosexuality is not a choice and that it often results in loneliness. Quote, "We of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints reach out with understanding and respect for individuals who are attracted to those of the same gender. I don't think you respect someone if it's a bad choice they've made. I think they understand it's not a choice. And because several of us have been in dialogue with a number of the key general authorities, we've been told that by them directly. It's not a choice. They don't believe it is." The statement goes on. "We realize there may be great loneliness in their lives." Realistically speaking, both married and single people can experience loneliness, but this statement at least seems to suggest that homosexuals will not be able to marry. That's the way I interpret their statement. I think they understand that the feelings don't go away, and they're sending a message that there's a life of loneliness. Now, that's the next issue, of course. If these feelings don't go away, what are people going to do with them? And the church leaders are recommending that they not act on those feelings. Here's another really fine development in my mind. In December 2004, just last December, during an interview on CNN television, Larry King asked President Hinckley if gays are born that way. The president answered, quote, "I don't know. I'm not an expert on these things. I don't pretend to be an expert on these things." Close quote. It is really helpful when the prophet makes clear that understanding the causes of homosexuality requires expertise. In other words, it is not a matter that has been settled by revelation. And that the church's position on homosexuality may include the possibility that individuals are born that way. That's what our prophet has said within the last few months. So I call these really promising developments. Now, this little booklet that we said we'd tell you a little bit about is also part of that new promising era that I'm talking about. We have worked on this book for some time, over 5 years, Bob and Bill and Mary Beth and I. And we have worked with a number of key general authorities in developing this. And we were eventually able to take this to Deseret Book, and as a companion within Quiet Desperation, they have picked up the distribution of this so that it is in currently in about 40 Deseret bookstores. It is called A Guide for Latter-day Saint Families Dealing with Homosexual Attraction, and everything here reinforces what I've just said about these two issues. It's not a choice, and it doesn't go away. So I think we're in a good place. I would like that if we could get every bishop to have a copy of this. In fact, I've got enough copies here with me this morning. We're not giving them away to you because you need to go buy yours at Benchmark Books, but if you'll take one to your bishop or your church leader, I've got as many here as you will need. I think seminary teachers, institute teachers, all kinds of Relief Society leaders ought to have this book. The references here, the people who are quoted are President Hinckley, Elder Oaks, President Hinckley, etc. That's where this information is coming from, but it is more compassionate, more understanding, more helpful than anything I think you've seen at Deseret Book before. So I call it this a good sign. Now, we've also, in our group here, been working. We call ourselves Resources for Understanding Homosexuality, and we've prepared a DVD that we showed one of the videos from last night in our session here. And as part of this DVD, there's a story of a young single man, Gary Horlocker, who's here this morning, who for 10 years tried to get married, and who beautifully tells his story about how he, over this 10 years, gradually began to understand that he had attractions to men and they were not going away. And then there's the second video, which is of a married man, Russ Gorringe, who spent 25 years in a marriage. Some people think, well, if you just get married, that shows that, you know, it's going to work. Well, as this 40% that I talked about earlier shows, it doesn't mean it's going to work just because you get into marriage. And Russ was married for 25 years, and there was no sex in that marriage for 12 years. And they finally decided to call it quits because that was not working for them. There's also a third story of a family, an LDS family, 11 children, four of them gay, three gay males and a lesbian daughter. And so the stories about our LDS people and how they have experienced this firsthand, it was not a choice for them, it did not go away, and how they have resolved this in their lives, I think, are part of the resources. So that's the good news. And I hope there will be more, and I hope you'll help us spread the good news.
I am going to talk about In Quiet Desperation, the new book. If Sister Marilyn Mattis happens to either be in the room or listen to a tape with my remarks, I want her to know that I love her, that she is my sister in the gospel and in Jesus, and that I respect her as a person. It's just that I have too many problems with her statements and what she says in this book. Last year, Deseret Book published In Quiet Desperation, the first time in years that Deseret Book has produced a volume on the subject of homosexuality. If the Guide for Latter-day Saints Families, written by Robert Rees, Ron Scow, and others, is a city on a hill giving light to the world, then this new book, In Quiet Desperation, is like a thunderstorm approaching the city. The storm may miss the city altogether, or it may fall as rain and provide some badly needed water, or it may hit the whole country with such a violence as to completely rearrange the geography. In Quiet Desperation is not really one book. Its two parts are two distinctive books, so radically different that one wonders how possibly they could have been put together in one single volume. The first essay in the book is one of the most hopeless readings I have done in a long time. The second part is so subversively progressive that it is destined to either shred everything we heard in church about homosexuality or to spark a reactionary move by church leaders and become the object of the shredding. The first 50 pages are an essay by Marilyn Mattis, the mother of Stuart Mattis. Stuart is a young man who killed himself on the steps of the Stake Center in Los Altos, California, at the time when the Mormon Church was involved in a political campaign to help pass an anti-gay law in California. The second part of the book is written by Ty Mansfield, a returned missionary from Alexandria, Virginia, who has not only accepted the fact that he's gay, but has also decided to be celibate and to continue to participate in the church. The narrative that the Mattises have created over the years around the death of their son is contradictory. In the year 2000, they told the Associated Press that the death of their son had nothing to do with Proposition 22. In an October 2004 interview, Sister Mattis admitted exactly the opposite, that it was indeed Proposition 22 that pushed Stuart over the top. In the first part of this new book, the church and its leaders emerge with clean hands. Sister Maris admits that the church asked members to support Proposition 22, but according to her, that was not what really triggered Stuart's death. What really disturbed Stuart, says Sister Maris, was the fact that some of the church members went beyond what was asked of them and became hostile in their remarks towards gay and lesbian people. Sister Maris describes a culture in which church members and church leaders have created a system of spiritual codependency. Under such a system, no one can possibly find blame in anyone else. When bad things happen, they are guiltless tragedies. Let me propose a different way to look at the issue, and let me be as blunt as I can in the questions that I want to ask. How much do we really value the lives of our gay Mormon youth? Is our Mormon stance on homosexuality more important than their lives? Prophets have reassured us that the afterlife and the millennium will put in place every missing piece of our theological puzzles. But this fixation on how everything will be solved in the afterlife can end up by consuming any desire to carry on in this life. Such seems to be the horrific implication of the essay written by Sister Maris. With no hope for a cure in this life, Marilyn and Fred Maris find comfort in a vision of a Stuart who, upon his death, magically leaves his same-sex attraction behind and finds an eternal wife in the spirit world. I am frankly appalled at the narrative that Sister Maris creates around the suicide of her son. Everyone in the story does what they are supposed to do. When the parents learn that Stuart has bought a gun, they go to the temple where they receive a great sense of peace. After the suicide, Elder Holland of the Quorum of the Twelve tells the Matises that even though suicide is not the answer to life's problems, he knows that the mercy of the atonement covered Stuart's last desperate act. So all is well in Zion. Or is it? Do the ends justify the means? Could the Mormon culture of salvation have become for some devout gays a culture of death? Here's a quote from page 20. Although losing our son was difficult, it has been comforting to know that he was faithful to his temple covenants. Jason Clark, from Affirmation Gay and Lesbian Mormons, responds to Sister Maris in the following manner. As a gay Mormon, what am I supposed to conclude from this statement? That I should kill myself rather than to be sexually active? Your statement, Clark writes to Sister Maris, resonates with a troubling, oft-quoted anecdote by Marion G. Romney. According to Elder Romney's story, before leaving for his LDS mission, his father told him, "We would rather come to this station and take your body off the train in a casket than to have you come home unclean, having lost your virtue." I guess I wouldn't be so negative in my assessment of Sister Maris' narrative if I thought that the death of Stuart was an isolated incident. But as Bob Rees mentioned, it is not. Sister Maris, dozens of gay Mormons have killed themselves since the 1970s, and hundreds have attempted suicide. Sister Maris cites Elder Holland saying that suicide is not the answer to life's problems. But in her story, suicide is indeed the answer. I think it will take a deeper act of self-examination for church leaders and members to understand the enormity of the problem we are facing. But now, contrast the Maris' narrative with the one presented in the second part of the book. Tyne Mansfield opens his 200-page essay by telling of an experience he had when he was a missionary assigned to visit an inactive man. As it turned out, the man and his partner, who was also LDS, had been living together for nearly two decades. "I was intrigued and intensely confused," writes Ty, "for he was not what I had always understood homosexuals were. He was a good, kind, and normal-looking man." This is a remarkable opening. As far as I can tell, this is the first time a Deseret Book publication admits that homosexuals can live as partners rather than as serial fornicators. "Committed couples," says Ty, "do exist. There are many who seek, as best they can, to live lives that are pleasing to God and of service to others. Even love expressed in ways contrary to God's eternal purposes still retains elements of God's grandeur, love's grandeur." What a remarkable declaration. With a single stroke of a pen, Ty challenges 50 years of LDS statements that describe homosexuality as acts of perversion, addiction, and selfishness. Furthermore, Ty refuses to characterize homosexuality as gender confusion. Instead, he develops an idea that the guy for Latter-day Saint families also advances, and that is completely novel in church publications. Homosexuality is, it turns out, better understood as a question of sexual orientation. Tye's essay includes some remarkable descriptions of what it is like for a gay man to fall in love with another man, how this attraction can have a strong romantic component, how it can feel good and right and natural, what it is like to meet someone that you connect with emotionally, physically, spiritually, who seems to complete you in every way. The essay by Marilyn Mattis doesn't include much in terms of advice. She does say that parents must be open in their discussion of same-sex attraction and help their children understand the difference between same-sex attraction and homosexual activity. Good advice for beginners, but not sufficient for Ty, who instead of obsessing about sexual activity, finds liberation and peace in saying, "I am gay." As many of you know, the word gay has so far been taboo in Mormon discourse because it suggests that your sexual orientation is part of your identity. Yet Ty dares not only to use the word gay, but also to put his sexual identity in its proper context. "Although I have no problem with the word gay or other terms," he says, "there are 100 other ways I would describe myself before I would use any of them. I am a son and a brother. I am a nephew and an uncle. I am a God in embryo with unlimited potential for progress and attainment." Mormonism is heavily permeated by a kind of perfectionism, by this idea that you must gradually improve yourself, keep the commandments a little bit better each day, thus becoming gradually perfect. Stuart Mattis was heavily invested in this Mormon perfectionism. According to Sister Mattis, he engaged in a strict regimen of self-punishment and discipline. In contrast with Stuart's effort to achieve peace through action, Ty says that he conquered his challenge through inaction. "He cannot change his attraction for man," he concludes, "but God can change his heart." Heavily influenced by statements from Stephen Robinson, Robert Millett, and Jeffrey Holland, Ty moves from a theology of perfectionism to a theology of sanctification. This is not to say that Ty thinks it's okay to be sexually active, but it is to say that celibacy, sexual repression, and dubious programs of behavior modification are no longer the focus. Writes Ty, "People have often said that unless I was true to my real self and found a male companion to share my life with, I could never be truly happy. My response to that is this: I have found Christ, my God and my King." If Ty rejects the idea of having a partner, it's not because he doesn't believe he can build a long-term relationship or find some genuine level of fulfillment or temporal happiness. Rather, writes Ty, "It was a simple truth that I knew my having a romantic relationship with a man could never be eternal." Thus, Ty doesn't reject the idea of a partner because it's disgusting or unnatural or immoral. He rejects it only on theological grounds. In sum, it seems to me that there are three basic attitudes gay Mormons can assume toward homosexuality. The first one is to try to conquer your gayness, to break it the way you try to break a wild horse. This approach seems to lead to a profound sense of frustration and hopelessness. Stuart Mattis tried it, and he failed. The second approach is to embrace your gayness, to celebrate it, and possibly to become sexually active. If I read Ty's essay correctly, then we should no longer condemn those who are sexually active. We should respect them. They can be good people. Monogamy is much better than promiscuity. The third approach is simply to change your focus, to no longer obsess about your gayness. Focus instead on Jesus Christ, on his grace acting equally on all sinners and all sins. Let me finish by saying that I don't think the church is yet, overall, a healthy place for gay and lesbian people. Gays and lesbians often feel that the church and its teachings are poisoning their lives. If you feel that you have to choose between your church and your life, I say leave the church and run with your life. Now, having said that, I have a lot of respect for Ty Mansfield and a lot of hope for his life. "I am gay," he says. "When I read this simple act of reaffirmation, I do not know if he will end up marrying a woman and having children. I do not know if he will end up as a bachelor. I don't know if he will end up finding a same-sex partner. But I don't really care, for this I know, he will not end up committing suicide. He will survive." Thank you.
To oversimplify a very complicated matter, the one that we're talking about this morning, one could pose the issue in terms of three questions. The first one is, what is known about the causes of homosexuality? What are its origins? The second, which naturally flows from the first, is regardless of those mechanisms responsible, is it susceptible to change? And the larger question, of course, is how does one perceive, understand homosexual relationships? My brief comments this morning will pertain to the first of these questions, and that is, what is the current status of scientific inquiry about the causes of homosexuality? My professional training is in biochemistry. At BYU, I attempt to teach students how to improve their ability to think analytically and solve problems and get better at scientific reasoning in the context of courses in molecular biology and cell biology. I have not myself conducted research into the biology of homosexuality. I am a reader of the literature. I have attempted to stay as current as I can on the publications in the scientific journals that bear on this issue. On this overhead transparency are some references. I don't show it expecting you to remember the authors or the names of the papers, but I would be pleased to provide those references to any of you who might be interested. What I hope to do by projecting this image is to make you realize that there is an extraordinary amount of recent experimental evidence suggesting a very, very strong tie between homosexuality and certain biochemical and biological mechanisms that might be responsible. The first of the references is written by two investigators at the University of London, who several years ago put together a very extensive review of the existing literature. It's dozens of pages long with thousands of references to studies in the realm of biochemistry, molecular biology, and neuroscience, all attempting to tease out elements of a very, very complex matter, and that is how gender and sexuality develop in both laboratory animals and in human beings. We all recognize that the impossibility of replicating in human beings the kinds of studies that are capable in laboratory animals. This particular reference is important because in September there will appear a book with almost the identical title, The Psychobiology of Human Sexual Orientation, with the elimination of the word human. A title will appear this September by the same authors that will present for the lay public, as best I can understand the pre-publication information about this book, present to the lay public this wealth of information about the connection between the biology and homosexuality. Let me skip down to the third reference. Let me just indicate the places where these reports have been published. The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the United States is one of the premier places where science in all its variations is presented to the American, to the worldwide scientific community. The journal Cell is one of the most selective of journals which entertain submissions on biological subjects. To go up one, Nature, along with Science Magazine, one of the two of the most important journals in which brief publications of significance are read and understood by the scientific community. Something very quick about two of these papers. In the PNAS paper published just a couple of months ago, the investigators looked at something that has long been thought not to exist in human beings, and that is a mechanism by which volatile biochemical compounds affect sexual behavior. These perfumes, if you will, to oversimplify, are called pheromones, and they have long been known to exist in many groups of organisms, especially insects. 5 years ago in textbooks, one would clearly, one would see the conclusion that pheromones do not play a part in sexual attraction or behavior in mammals, let alone human beings. This paper demonstrates the very likely existence of such biochemical mechanisms. So the study was performed in the following way. Two chemicals, one derived from the female steroid hormone estrogen and another derived from the male steroid hormone testosterone, were administered to heterosexual females, heterosexual males, and to homosexual men. In each of the persons being studied, the neuroscientists examined brain activity in that part of the brain called the hypothalamus, which has been known to be connected with neurological activities that affect sexual behavior. So in a terribly oversimplified way, imagine an individual is hooked up to an instrument so that the patterns of brain activity can be visualized when the neurons in the various areas of the brain are active. And the bottom line from the study is that the neurological behavior of homosexual men is essentially identical to that of heterosexual women and not like heterosexual men. So the paper provides very strong evidence for the first time that sexual behavior is influenced by biochemical molecules, that the brain is the receptor for those volatile compounds, and that homosexual men are distinctly unlike heterosexual men in this behavior, in this biological response. I note that I've left off a reference that I will only be able to talk about, which is absent from the screen. A month and a half ago, a paper appeared about a landmark study in which the genetics of homosexuality is very, very, very strongly substantiated. In this study, which was performed with fruit flies, a single biochemical gene was reversed in the male flies, and at several different levels of biochemistry and behavior, the single gene change caused a total feminization of the genetically male organisms, and the converse change was observed in the genetically female flies. Now, clearly fruit flies are not human beings, but you should know that there is an enormous amount of information that the genetic processes that program embryonic development are conserved between, if you will, the lower forms of animal life and mammals, including human beings. One final example. This is a representation of the front cover of Science magazine from July 1st of this year. The journal is devoted, as you can see, or perhaps not very well, 125 questions, what we don't know. So this journal of Science magazine is devoted to compiling a list of what remain as the most fundamental and interesting questions of science, the ones, those questions that are receiving the most attention from scientific investigators. Most of the 125 questions are not addressed in very great detail. There might be 10 of these questions to which a page or a page and a half of text is devoted. For the majority of the 125 questions, there's only a very brief reference. But what I want to show you then is that one of these addresses the question that we are focusing on today. The question is, what is the biological root of sexual orientation? Much of the, quote, environmental, quote, contribution to homosexuality may occur before birth in the form of prenatal hormones. So answering this question will require more than just the hunt for gay genes. Folks, for a long time it has been known that homosexuality has a very, very strong heritable component. But it's a complicated question, so that it is true that not 100%, for example, of identical twins, it is true that not 100% of both members of the pair exhibit the same sexual orientation. But the heritable component of homosexuality can be quantified by a value called heritability. That value is higher than 0.6, meaning that at least 60% of the variation in this trait is attributed to genes. The journal, with this statement, publicly makes clear an issue that is distorted significantly, especially by some in the LDS community, that the fact that there is variability in addition to that which is directly attributable to genes suggests that causes like, social causes like the presence of a domineering mother and an absent father in childhood relationships among parents and children might be the responsible factor in a person's becoming gay. The bottom line is that environmental here does not mean not biological. Environmental here does not mean necessarily social. Environmental here may be genetic, but a downstream or subsequent biological effect which originates in genes but manifests itself in things like the level of steroid hormones to which the brain is exposed at various times and in critical concentration levels. Don't go away trying to remember something about the hypothalamus or about pheromones or about any of the scientific details unless that's of interest. What I am clearly willing and anxious to portray to you is that there is a vast amount of evidence suggesting that homosexuality is rooted in biochemical causes. Our understanding of these mechanisms is in its infancy. No one is capable of presenting an overhead to you that would detail in all accurate levels of complexity how the genes work, what the pathways by which the molecules operate are. We're just beginning to understand those sorts of things. But at the same time, if one compares the level of rigor of the evidence for biological causes with the level of rigor for non-biological causes, it's not a contest. There is very, very little compelling empirical evidence to suggest social and psychological causes for homosexuality. I think there's a lot of evidence that homosexuality can have a subsequent influence psychologically and socially. But as a causal factor for homosexuality, the evidence for social interactions, for childhood experiences, for relationships among parents is not strong. Latter-day Saint parents of gay men and women should be proud of their children and not feel guilty that something that they did as parents was responsible for this condition in their children. Not everyone in the homosexual community is supportive of attempts to understand the biology of this process. There are probably at least two reasons for that. There may be concerns about the history of past attempts in the eugenics movement to see homosexuals as biological defects, to be treated inappropriately, even to be sterilized or to put to death. The fact that there is a biological component to this condition should not mean that we should think of it as a defect. It is indefensible and it is irresponsible for people in our community or in any other community to distort the fact that there is evidence of this kind to suggest that the science is incorrect or that the scientific evidence is waning. In part, the complexity of understanding the experiments is such that if people are not trained in scientific biological examination of scientific design and the relevant data, that they are easily misled about the compelling nature of this evidence. I want to finish with just one example of that. What I'm going to do is going to make all of you start looking at your hands. One of the ways in which men and women differ biologically is in the length of our fingers. The length of the fourth digit is longer in males than in females. And one way to measure this condition is to, define it is to measure the ratio of the index finger to the fourth finger. that characteristic is sexually dimorphic, so that that ratio is longer in females than males, because the male fourth finger is longer than it is in women. There's a lot of evidence that this is a reflection of steroid hormone levels, that it that the exposure to the embryo to these hormones, that the exposure occurs during embryonic life, so that it's certainly not subject to the will of the individual. A lot of studies have been made, and the studies have found differences between lesbian women and heterosexual women. The studies have found differences between gay men and heterosexual men. But the direction of the differences has not always been the same. In some of the studies, homosexual men are super masculinized. In some of the studies, the homosexual men are feminized. A paper appeared 2 weeks ago. I'm showing you one of the figures from the paper. It was the last of the references on the initial sheet. The various bars in the histogram represent different studies by different groups of investigators. In this review article, scientists did not instigate a meta-study. That is, they didn't just talk about the relationships among the studies. They got the original data from all of the participants, and they redid all of the analyses because they wanted to understand why there was this discrepancy. And the one thing I want to leave you with is the complexity of trying to do work of this kind. So just look at one thing.
On the left-hand side of the figure are a series of histograms, and there's an error bar indicating the degree of variability in those studies. The same thing on the right. What I think you can observe is that the degree of variation in the right-hand bar is much less than the variation is in the left-hand histogram. Well, the data from the right-hand studies are from the homosexual group. The error bars on the left are from the heterosexual group. And the take-home message is the variability in these studies doesn't reside in the homosexual group of person studies, it resides in the heterosexual group of people. We don't know the reason for that. Is it because there are ethnic differences among people with regard to the biology of this? That's a possibility, but this remains a mystery, at least until next year, when maybe the current studies will find a way to resolve this.
On an entirely different level, I just want to express my love and appreciation for my gay brothers and sisters.
I want you to note the difference between the what I consider humble and cautious presentation of responsible scientist and this statement from the Fair Review to which I referred. The authors and the publishers of In Quiet Desperation fail to note that the biological theory of homosexuality has been thoroughly discredited by most credible scientific researchers. I hope that you will take an opportunity, Ron's invitation, to take a copy of our pamphlet to give to your bishop or stake president. I hope you will buy a copy for yourself from the bookshop next door. I hope you will write a letter to Deseret Book saying that you appreciate them publishing In Quiet Desperation and this publication. This Fair Review attacks Deseret book as being irresponsible for having published In Quiet Desperation, and I think Deseret Book should be, in fact, applauded for that. If you're interested, there will be Hugo's review of In Quiet Desperation is appearing in Sunstone. Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, yes.
It's
going to
be different, yes.
Okay. My review will appear in, I believe, the next issue of Dialogue. Let me just say one final word about this article, a slippery slope that limits the atonement. I said earlier that I think that the most damaging thing of this is not that these authors attack Mansfield and Mattis. In fact, this statement, though Mansfield notes that his homosexual feelings have remained unchanged, this is impossible. I'd rather trust Mansfield about his feelings than somebody else. They say the truths of the gospel do not contradict the truths of science. Indeed, the truths of science support the gospel's view of change. I've just been doing some study of early photographs and early images of Joseph Smith, and I would remind the authors of this book that early members of the church believed very much in the science of phrenology and understanding Joseph Smith's psyche through looking at his head. So science is always tentative to some extent, and we need to be humble about it. But the thing that I find most disturbing about this is what it suggests about the atonement, that the atonement itself is somehow capable of changing one's sexual orientation. They say in the conclusion to this, appropriate professional help along with the healing powers of the gospel have repeatedly convinced us that there is no struggle for which the atonement is not sufficient. That may be true, that there is no struggle, but they also suggest that the atonement could be sufficient to change one's sexual orientation. I'd like to open this up for some questions. But I wanted to cite in reference to this book, which I find there are many things which are a distraction, that in the Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis has his senior devil, Screwtape, give the following advice to one of his apprentices. The important thing, he says, is to distract their attention. The game is to have all of them running around with fire extinguishers whenever there's a flood. Now, if you want to come up and address a question to a member of the panel or just a general question, please do so, but do it from here so it can be recorded. If you want someone is asking a question, you can take a seat up here and wait your turn so we don't miss the time.
My question is for the authors of this guide that Ron Scow spoke about. In doing some research for my panel later this afternoon, I did a quick search on DeseretBook.com and just used a keyword homosexuality to see what books would be brought up. And Ty Mansfield's book and this did not return a search, even though the keyword homosexuality is in the title of the book. I thought that was pretty fascinating. However, books that were returned in the search were just a couple here. Turn Yourselves and Live, Is Anything Too Hard for the Lord? Homosexuality, Symptoms and Free Agency, and A Parent's Guide to Preventing Homosexuality. So while I do commend the book and think it's a wonderful thing and a wonderful step in the right direction, I kind of wonder what's happening at Deseret Book as far as the promoting of the book and if you've experienced any having it being thrown in the back of the back of the bookstore.
I can tell you that I called that to the attention of the webmaster when it first appeared, and I asked for changes and so on for it to be added. I know you can put in homosexual attraction, and it comes up. I know you can put in our names, and it comes up. So we'll just have to follow this up and see if we can get that fixed. But thanks for the comment.
Let me me add very briefly that if you do go to this book, it's wonderful to see both In Quiet Desperation and The Guide next to each other. They are really on the shelves.
My question is for Dr. Bradshaw. You've been fairly diplomatic, I think, in some of your comments here, and my question invites you to be less so. And so I understand if you want to decline that invitation. But my question is this. Unless I'm misunderstanding them, it seems pretty clear to me that LDS psychologists like Dean Bird disagree with you regarding the presence of compelling evidence for biochemical causes and the lack of compelling evidence for social causes. And I'm curious if you could comment as to why that disagreement exists.
Dr. Bird's has been at certain times and until perhaps very recently a spokesperson who was respected by church leaders and whose advice was sought. Clearly he has staked his professional and perhaps his position as a faithful member of the church on this particular position. The biological evidence threatens that. Clearly his response, I think, is an attempt to justify that position. What I would do is invite all of you to read some of the papers and decide for yourself.
My question is a follow-up to Mr. Duffy's question, and it's not directed at any one panelist, so anyone is free to answer. There's a lot of discussion about the scientific basis for homosexuality, but I think in a church setting, even if the scientific basis for homosexuality is proven, shown, demonstrated completely, and I'm not sure that we will ever get there, or that that's necessarily important, but if it were accepted in the scientific community that there was a cause for homosexuality, is that really going to affect the church's position? And is that really the direction that is that really something that is going to be compelling for the brethren to change their position or their statements on homosexuality in the future? I guess this is more of a question of how do the brethren define sin and the things that they're referring to as sin currently.
I would like to respond quickly. It's quite true that even if we had an absolutely compelling, totally defined, complete and accurate and absolutely confirmed model for the biology, that would not solve the question, the dilemma. It would certainly lead us to focus on the question of, regardless of the causes, can change be achieved? But what I think will happen, what I think is likely, what I know has happened in some instances, is that when the biological evidence is examined and people find that it is compelling, then they become more sympathetic, more willing to listen. They will no longer shun conversations with gay people. And if anything is going to change us or anyone else, it's because we get to become acquainted with gay and lesbian people. We find that their goodness a lot of times exceeds our own, and it's at that level that we will begin to make change.